Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And for the first time, Robin, I will say good evening to you.
Yes.
Because I am in London, where this is a big day for Brexit, the UK decision to leave the European Union. This was the scene earlier today in the House of Commons during Prime Minister's questions. Theresa May defended her plan, which her government has been reviewing since last night, for this historic divorce.
I'm confident that this takes us significantly closer to delivering on what the British people voted for in the referendum.
And this was the opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn, who dismissed that claim.
So does the Prime Minister still intend to put a false choice to Parliament between her botched deal or no deal?
So, Robin, at this hour, Prime Minister May is meeting with her cabinet. The meeting is running long. We will be right on top of it, and we'll have more on Brexit all hour.
Oh, pins and needles there, Jeremy. We look forward to this. But meanwhile, here at home, at least 50 people are now dead in the wildfires in California. 48 of them in the Camp Fire north of Sacramento, the deadliest fire in California history. And with 200 people still missing there in the north, it's feared that the grim search through ashes is going to raise that number significantly. FEMA Administrator Brock Long and Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke are in the state today to survey damage with Governor Jerry Brown. In Southern California, firefighters are battling several fires. Thousands are evacuated or homeless. The fire in the north is only 35% contained. NPR correspondent Eric Westervelt is there in Chico, up in Butte County in Northern California. And Eric, talk first about this search for the missing. This has become a very sad science.
Yeah, I mean, the search for remains continues. It's a slow, methodical, and grim job as folks with cadaver dogs and teams go house to house. About 90% of Paradise, at least the housing stock, was destroyed, maybe half of the downtown sort of business area. And they're just going, you know, door to door, continue to look for remains. And then there's still, you know, the missing that folks aren't sure are they dead, or you know, have they gone to a friend's and they haven't checked in with authorities or families? And there are these, you know, sad messages on message boards at shelters and donation centers with, you know, photos of the missing and handwritten notes and pleas for any information, you know, about relatives and friends. And authorities, we should say, haven't really updated the number still missing, but earlier in the week that figure was more than 200, Robin, and Butte County Sheriff said last night a list of the missing would be released soon. He also asked for another 100 National Guard troops called in to help teams already looking for remains.
Oh, terrible. But meanwhile, the matter of losing homes. I mean, people are still worried about relatives, but they also have lost so many homes. You know, are shelters full? You said people might be staying with friends. And what happens next week and the week after that and the week after that?
Yeah, I mean, the temporary shelters, you know, are getting lots of donations and warm meals, and things are running pretty smoothly there. Remarkably, you know, given what's happened, people's spirits are up. But yeah, long term, you know, there's mounting concern about getting housing for many of these displaced. You know, rebuilding will take years. And, you know, this displaced population is predominantly low and moderate income. And the Housing Authority folks I've talked to here say, look, we just don't know where they're going to go long term. Even before the fire, Robin, there was a near zero vacancy rate in this county, one of the state's poorest, you know, and the state and the county had this housing availability and affordability crisis. This fire makes that problem worse.
We've spoken here about how in the south of the state, a lot of the fires there were burning in suburbs and seaside towns. No trees, really, to speak of. Here in the north, in Paradise, for instance, this is a town that grew out of an old mining town in the woods, quaint and had so much character, which is why people loved it, but it was in the woods. I know you told us yesterday, people aren't really thinking ahead, that, you know, trying to figure out what to do in the next hour. But is there a sense that, you know, we can't go back in the woods?
You know, the mayor told NPR's All Things Considered last night, you know, we are committed to rebuilding. We will rebuild. And there's signs up, you say, you hear, you know, Butte County strong and rebuild Paradise. But, you know, the housing authority official I talked to, he's throwing some cold, hard reality on that, saying, you know, a lot of these people may not have been insured. They don't have a lot of money to begin with. Some are elderly. They need services. Rebuilding will take years. And again, there isn't the housing stock here. He worries that some of these folks may have to leave the state. He said if they don't, they might become part of a homeless population.
Look, less than a minute. Eric, we know in the South they were talking about the Santa Ana winds blowing, you know, this hot air and maybe some power lines, you know, having a spark that ignited there. Do we know what caused this campfire?
Well, the campfire cause is under investigation, but both PG&E and Southern California Edison reported to regulators, Robin, that they experienced problems with transmission lines or these substations in areas around the time the blaze were first reported. And this week, several law firms representing victims filed a lawsuit against PG&E alleging negligence and health and safety code violations. PG&E, you know, responded saying, "We're cooperating. The cause is not known, and we're focused on restoring power and electricity, you know, when it's safe to do so." But clearly, a huge issue ahead. There's a lot of anger on the ground at PG&E. Yeah. There's a lot of anger.
NPR's Eric Westerveld in Chico, California. Eric, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Well, it didn't get Amazon HQ2, but the small town of Rockdale, Texas, was chosen for what some people say will be the largest Bitcoin mine in the country. Bitcoin mining is a process that uses rows of computer processors to solve complex computations and release the digital currency known as Bitcoin. The Chinese company Bitmain plans to build a data center that is expected to bring hundreds of jobs to Rockdale. And as Paul Flav of Texas Public Radio reports, the town is no stranger to booms and busts.
In 1952, the Saturday Evening Post ran a story called "The Town Where It Rains Money" about Rockdale. Just 2 years prior, the Central Texas town's coal mine had been closed and Rockdale's future uncertain. So how did it go from being on the ropes to awash in cash?
This is aluminum.
The Aluminum Company of America, Alcoa, moved to town. It found the area's plentiful lignite coal could power their aluminum smelting. The Texas State Historical Association estimates 300,000 tons of the cheap, dirty stuff was burned in the company's power plant each year.
Our smelting works are located at Alcoa, Tennessee, Point Comfort, and Rockdale, Texas.
The company invested $100 million. That's more than $950 million today. But after years of depressed aluminum prices, Alcoa pulled out in 2008. They sold the plant, laid off 850 people, and many more left.
It is closing the Sandow 4 and 5 plants just southwest of Rockdale. That's in Milam County. In all, 450 people will lose their jobs.
Last year, the coal power plant that had been limping along closed. Between the smelter and the plant, 1,700 jobs were gone. The largest employers in the county closed. For many, the town, population 5,600, was back on the ropes.
It made a hit on Rockdale. It hit us hard.
You know, you lose people, you lose income, you lose tax base, you lose a lot.
Charles Miles owns Miles Styles in downtown Rockdale, a barbershop surrounded by more than a few empty storefronts with for rent signs hanging. He's lived here all his life and is on the school board for the district his six children attend. Yeah. Miles says the area may be turning a corner, though.
They say history repeats itself.
He's talking about the August announcement that the Chinese-owned cryptocurrency company Bitmain is building a Bitcoin mine. Bitmain will invest $500 million, bring 400 jobs, and move into the old Alcoa smelter. Vincent Sorrells looks on as Miles cuts a customer's hair. He was a crane operator at Alcoa before he got laid off. He went back to school to become a barber, but that isn't working out how he thought.
There's no businesses really here. It still ain't picked up enough of me. So Bitcoin coming here just might bring people. Because, I mean, I can't pay the bills, you know, one cut a day.
Despite the hopes and optimism of what Bitmain could provide, Sorrells, like many here, doesn't know what they do.
No, sir, I don't. I mean, people come in and ask. I'm like, I never heard of it. I looked it up online even. I still couldn't get a grasp of it.
Conceptually, it's very similar to a data center.
Jeffrey Stearns is an executive vice president for Bitmain. He says Bitmain hasn't decided exactly how the location will be used. Bitmain is a massive player in bit mining. Analysts report the company has 85% of the market for the hardware that makes it possible. Whatever they end up building, the one thing they do know is it will need lots of energy.
Energy availability is one of the primary considerations, and also, you know, the cost associated with that energy.
And Stern says they can get that cheap available electricity in Rockdale. Towns across the country, from East Wenehatchee, Washington, to Plattsburgh, New York, have clashed with bit mining operations over driving up energy prices. Plattsburgh recently banned the practice. Rockdale City Manager Chris Whitaker says he doesn't know what impact it will have on energy prices, but he's focused on the positives of the deal, like Bitmain committing to hiring locally as much as it can.
So it's huge. It's a morale thing. It's a job thing. You know, so now we're getting an industry that's state of the art.
It's not make or break for Rockdale, says Whitaker, but it will go a long way towards changing their trajectory. Back at Miles Stiles, Edward May is getting his hair cut. For him, it's now about the company delivering on the town's hopes when it opens the facility in 2019.
Can they actually do it? Because it's been said before, and then, you know, things just burst. Things go up in flames and just don't last long. It's pretty much about can they prove themselves when they do come.
Taking a town where it once rained money and turning it into one where they mine it. For Here and Now, I'm Paul Flapp.
Today, Prime Minister Theresa May presented her plan for Britain's exit from the European Union to her cabinet, with just about 4 months to go before the divorce will be final. In a few moments, we will get to what's going on now and what might happen next. But first, how did we get here, to the brink of an historic division? Let's go back to January of 2013. Nationalism and anti-Europe sentiment have been building in the UK, and Prime Minister David Cameron says he'll put the question to a vote.
It will be an in-out referendum. It is time for the British people to have their say. It is time for us to settle this question about Britain and Europe.
That referendum wouldn't happen for another 3.5 years, but Cameron makes his position known. The UK and Europe would be better off together. Then the people vote.
The total number of votes cast in favour of leave was 17,410,742.
On June 23rd, 2016, 52% vote to leave, 48% to remain. The reading of the official results shock the world.
This means that the UK has voted to leave the European Union. Yeah!
The British people have split with their Prime Minister, and the next day, Cameron's political career is over.
I will do everything I can as Prime Minister to steady the ship over the coming weeks and months. But I do not think it would be right for me to try to be the captain that steers our country to its next destination.
That duty would fall to Theresa May. On July 13, 2016, May becomes Prime Minister, and by March of the next year, she makes Brexit official. May triggers Article 50, a clause in the Treaty on European Union that allows EU member countries to leave the bloc.
This is an historic moment from which there can be no turning back. Britain is leaving the European Union. We are going to make our own decisions and our own laws. We are going to take control of the things that matter most to us.
It also sets the clock ticking. The treaty gives both sides 2 years to finalize the details of the divorce, details that were barely discussed before the referendum. What to do about the Irish border? How will people and goods move across the continent? In September, Theresa May rallied most of her cabinet behind a deal she called the Chequers Plan, which would keep the EU and the UK in a close relationship under a common rulebook and frictionless trade. Critics who wanted a clean break were not satisfied.
This is the moment to chuck Chequers.
Her foreign minister, Boris Johnson, resigned in protest.
If we get it wrong now and we proceed with this undemocratic solution, if you remain half in, half out, we will protract this toxic, tedious business that is frankly so off-putting to sensible, middle-of-the-road people who want us to stop talking about Europe and get on with their domestic priorities.
Critics like Johnson say the deal Theresa May is pitching to her cabinet today would still leave the UK unfairly tied to Europe. So that's where we are, with just 4 months to go before the Brexit deadline. Still not clear whether there will be a deal to make a clean break or no deal and potential chaos. We're going to bring in some journalists who've been covering this all along. But first, I want to go right to the BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson, who's at Westminster on a very busy day, busy evening. Rob, what is the latest? What's going on right now?
It certainly is an extraordinary moment. I also should say, Jeremy, that welcome to London. I'm almost wondering whether you have some sort of, I don't know, a bug inside Downing Street that you knew to come these 2 days after months.
Well.
I mean, it's extraordinary. After months and months since the referendum of not that much happening, you come at a truly historic moment. And to try and put this in some context for you, I mean, we've had a sort of form of cabinet government here since the mid-17th century, and this is probably one of the most important meetings in the last few hundred years. And that is because, A, the issue is immensely important, how and in what manner will Britain leave the European Union. And it's immensely important in the sense that this has been described as a moment of truth, day of judgment for Theresa May, because we're not sure at this point whether her government, now that they've got an outline of the deal, does it implode or does it sort of reluctantly get behind her, and that she then tries to take the whole deal to Parliament and get it through there as well. And what makes this such a truly dramatic moment is not just the immensely high stakes, but nobody, I don't think, genuinely knows how this ends. I think if Theresa May was here and you asked her, will you get your deal through your government and through Parliament, I think she would probably say, I don't know, but I'm certainly going to try.
Any predictions, Rob, about what's going to happen?
Well, I suspect that she'll probably get it through her inner circle of ministers, the cabinet, as we call it. I think she'll just about do that. Mm. I think the more difficult challenge is getting it through Parliament. And I'll just give you a little flavour of this. I mean, I have spoken to two politicians who I really like and trust, who I think are smart people. One said, yep, Rob, she's definitely going to get it through. It's going to be tough. And the other one said, no chance.
Okay. Rob Watson at Westminster, thank you, Rob. And let's bring in NPR London correspondent Frank Langford, who's here with me in the studio. And we're joined from Brussels by Bernd Riegert, who is senior European correspondent for Deutsche Welle. Frank, let me start with you. What is at stake here? What are the questions that you still have about what might happen next?
Well, I think the stakes are really, really big for the United Kingdom. One of the great risks here is if Theresa May can't get this through her cabinet or through Parliament, they could end up with a no deal, which would mean the United Kingdom walking away from an enormous economy, which could do a lot of damage and also just cause more friction with Europe at a very difficult time in this part of the world. And in terms of questions, the big question, I think, is exactly what Rob was talking about, is what's the math to get this through Parliament? Most of today, we've been hearing how so many factions in Parliament are against this.
Bernd Riegert, what is the view from Brussels as you watch what's going on right now?
Well, officials here in Brussels are keeping their fingers crossed and all eyes are on London. There's much optimism and hope that this is the final day. We are very, very close. And it won't get any better in the future. So this is the one and only chance, I guess. And as we speak, the ambassadors of the 27 other member states are being briefed by the negotiating team about the content of this 400 or 500 pages. We don't know yet. And here in Brussels, they still hope that this tonight will be the final negotiation night, because after 18 months and or 19 months of negotiation, everybody is exhausted and nobody has a better idea than that what is now in these papers. It waters down or comes down to a more or less comfortable customs union for the United Kingdom. And so the United Kingdom would have the same status as Turkey in the future.
But, you know, the interesting thing here is that if Theresa May is able to get it through her cabinet and get it through Parliament, it's still going to have to go through every single one of those 27 countries. But it seems, Bernd Riegert, like that's going to be the easy part, that they'll say yes if she can do it.
Yeah, it seems to be the easy part, because so far the 27 member states are really united, and this is maybe a little bit surprising for outsiders, but they are really united behind the negotiating team of Michel Barnier, and they also side with the Irish Prime Minister, whose country is, of course, most affected by Brexit. So it should be easy, if there is a deal, to get the ratification in all 27 member states. You never know. Maybe there's some little regional parliament in Belgium. We had that before that has special wishes. But I think if Britain agrees, then also the European Union will agree. And in the end, the final say has the European Parliament in Strasbourg, that also has to ratify the deal.
Frank, we have heard so many many different possibilities of what could happen, including today. Tony Blair, the former prime minister, was on television saying we should have another referendum. There are people that have said this is going to lead to the breakup of the United Kingdom because Northern Ireland is going to be off in a world of its own with Ireland. What's the most likely scenario? What's the scariest scenario as you see?
Well, I think those two scenarios are a bit much. I mean,
they're not going to happen.
It's not likely. I mean, this is incredibly uncertain. But the idea of a second referendum that would allow people to vote out, to vote to stay in the European Union, if you talk to people around and you also talk to politicians, there's very little stomach for that. And then in terms of what we've heard from the Democratic Unionist Party in Northern Ireland, the idea that this would break up the United Kingdom, that's pretty far-fetched. But it is creating a lot of stress inside. You know, one of the problems with Northern Ireland is they are very concerned of being cut off from the United Kingdom, having a border of some type in the Irish Sea between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. So there is a lot more stress that people are feeling in this country right now.
What does this mean for the United States?
It all depends on your perspective. You know, if you're a traditional American foreign policy person and you believe in the transatlantic alliance and a great relationship between France and the United Kingdom, the post-World War II allies, this is of great concern to you. You don't like to see this kind of strife in the United Kingdom and this sort of friction. And you hope that the UK would stay closer to the EU. Now, if you're Donald Trump, you actually don't like the EU. You don't want to see the UK in a close alignment with the European Union, and you'd like to see a much sharper split. Donald Trump is a Brexiteer.
Bernd Rieger, let me just finally go back to you, just 30 seconds here. But do you think that at the end of all of this, you'll have a stronger or a weaker Europe?
That's the million-dollar question. So far, Europe is more united when it comes to Brexit. But of course, losing Britain and the British economy and Britain as a factor for security policy is not a good thing for the European Union.
That is Bernd Rieger, who has been joining us from Brussels. He's senior European correspondent for Deutsche Welle. He says the weather is not good in Brussels. The weather is nice here in London, where we've got NPR's Frank Langfitt. It's going to be a very interesting evening, Frank,
yes,
to see
it will.
What happens. How would you say this is compared to other days with Brexit?
This reminds me of the vote in terms of something so crucial. So you'd have to go back more than 2 years, that crucial vote that surprised the world.
That is Frank Langfitt, and we will have more throughout the hour.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
No one is safe. I'm talking about those video screens popping up on gas station pumps. Beware. You may stand in a stupor and watch the screen. You can't avoid them. But it is also watching you. Here and Now's media analyst John Carroll is here. Hi, John.
Hi, Robin.
And so you understand this started with 5 screens, an experiment in Texas, and it has now exploded.
It certainly has. It's a company called GSTV, and they have screens and ads in 18,000 gas stations in 200 markets across the country. They say they get 75 million unique views per month and reach 1 in 3 American adults above the age of 18.
Because you can't avoid them. And the way it works is each screen essentially has this audience of one, which is you, as you're filling your tank. So what are they putting on it?
Traditionally, they put on snippets of news, sports, entertainment, and ads that have been pretty straightforward. A lot of the ads are for go inside and buy some cookies in the gas station. So basically that was what it was.
Yeah, but now it's customized to neighborhoods now.
Right. So in 2014, they had 2,600 gas stations, and they customized them to neighborhoods so that you would basically be steered toward businesses in the location of the gas station. Somebody said it was less like TV and more like billboards.
Yeah. So they're selling, you know, that's one thing. But now they're collecting data and selling. So tell us more about that.
Right. So they just introduced this data analytical system called Octane. And what it does is it tracks your transactional, your geolocation, your online consumer behavior. So basically, you know, they are able to tell where pretty much where you're coming from and where you're going. So they have your credit card, so they know where you live. They can tap into your smartphone to find out what gas station you're at. They crunch together online activity. And so basically they're able to figure out what would be the best ads to target to you at that particular time.
This is so frightening. So they know where you are, but they also claim that they can show the effect by looking at all this data. They can show the effect of the ads on the screens.
Right, because they can track where you go afterwards. So for instance, you know, you're filling up your car at 6:15 p.m. They know you're close to home. They know you go to Wendy's fairly often. So they send you a coupon from the local Wendy's, which is 4 blocks away. And they say, go in and we'll give you a free order of French fries. And then they can track whether you go in or not and pay with your credit card.
And so Pepsi, General Motors, Citibank, Wendy's. These are major leaguers that are being involved as well. ESPN, CNN, Headline News, Bloomberg TV, in this kind of streaming service that they're doing, you know, that they're getting their content from. Where does this go?
Well, where it goes is basically more and more people are seeing video, not on television screens, but streaming video on various devices. So this is going to become another device that people are going to use to reach an audience and to some degree reach a younger audience that is more prone to those kinds of media platforms.
And then take all the information they want from your credit card and your phone. Boy, I'm the kind of person, I stand there at the pump and I can't hear you. La, 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 I can't hear you. John Carroll, media analyst for Here and Now. No place is safe. We'll link you to his Campaign Outsider blog, by the way, at our website, hereandnow.org. John, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
I'm broadcasting today from London, where Prime Minister Theresa May has struck a deal to leave the European Union. May met with her cabinet today to sell ministers on a draft of the plan. It would create a backstop customs arrangement to prevent border checkpoints between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and the Republic of Ireland, which will remain in the EU. That issue has been holding up a final deal for months, and nothing is settled yet because May's solution could still fall apart in Parliament. Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd has been out speaking with people who are worried along both sides of the Irish border.
Whew. If you're looking for ground zero in the war over Brexit, this is it, right here, where the River Foyle opens up into the sea.
This is beautiful, and there's no doubt about it. It's a pleasure to come down here to work.
We're standing in the Republic of Ireland on the shore of William Lynch's farm.
Let's see here. That water's cold. I hope the oysters like cold water, which I guess they do.
The tide is in, not much to see, but just below the water, his crop of Pacific oysters is growing.
My other site in Northern Ireland is about 2 miles up, 10 minutes driving the tractor.
Well, you're in a pickle then, aren't you, with all this Brexit stuff?
I am really in a pickle.
Lynch's livelihood straddles two countries. This year, he's harvested 90 tons of oysters from the farm, some from Northern Ireland in the UK, some from the Republic of Ireland in the south. All of them were shipped to France to be distributed around the world.
It is vital to my operations. I need to have free movement.
Brexit poses questions that Lynch has no answers to. How does he move the oysters a few miles down the road into Northern Ireland, where his company is based? What kind of tariffs would he pay? Would the oysters spoil if there's a delay at a new checkpoint on the border?
Probably the quick solution for me would be to close down the company in Northern Ireland and relocate it here to Southern Ireland. And that really would be my backstop, which is a great word, come into the vocabulary now.
Which is a word a lot of people are using here.
So I might as well jump on the bandwagon. That would be my backstop.
Lynch is a poster boy for an as-of-yet intractable problem. Brexit negotiators on both sides have promised there will be no hard border, no physical infrastructure. The British ambassador to the U.S., Kim Derrick, told me as much back in April.
Prime Minister has pledged absolutely there is going to be no hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland.
Do you think people in Northern Ireland are hearing that message?
Well, we couldn't be any clearer. I mean, I hope people in Northern Ireland will accept that when the government says something as clearly and as emphatically as we've said it, then that's what we're going to stick to, and they can trust us to one way or another deliver this.
Theresa May is now one step closer to delivering. She met with her cabinet earlier today to get them behind the deal she struck with Europe. It appears to leave the entire UK in a temporary EU customs arrangement until a final trade deal is worked out. That backstop would prevent border checkpoints, but it's a fundamental problem for Brexiteers who want a clean break with Europe. Key members of Parliament have already said they're against it. As time runs out, people in the Northern Ireland border city of Derry are confused.
The uncertainty?
Tony Forrester lives in town, but like so many here, she crosses to the south every day to go to work. She's director of the Letterkenny Chamber of Commerce in County Donegal.
In the last 2.5 years, the uncertainty has been the biggest problem. Nobody really knows what to do. Nobody really knows how to plan for something that they don't understand. If the UK go out of Brexit with a no deal and we have world trade tariffs, we just don't know how that's going to work. We don't know how much our goods will have to go up. And in the Republic of Ireland, lots of our businesses, retailers, every type of business, buys goods in the UK. So they're worried about their supply chain.
Of course they are, because they're right next to each other, right? How much trade, how many goods flow back and forth between this area?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure about the figures. I think someone mentioned 3 billion a year. I talked to a lot of our retailers, and I've said to them, what have you done? And they said, not much. Haven't planned very much. And I said, well, have you talked to your suppliers, who are mostly wholesalers? Oh, yeah, well, they're okay, because they've got it sorted out. But actually, I don't think anybody has.
They don't.
I don't really believe that.
Forrester is unsure if Theresa May can get her plan through Parliament. But she is sure of one thing. This problem of a hard border is about more than money.
I remember only a military border. I don't remember a customs border. So for me, the border is military. It was about being stopped every time, 10 miles down the road. And that they're bad memories for everyone in Northern Ireland, no matter what your background.
Can nobody get an ambulance?
Go!
This is BBC archival footage from January 30th, 1972, Bloody Sunday. Perhaps the most infamous day in 3 decades of sectarian violence between Protestants and Catholics, known as the Troubles.
My young brother, Michael Kelly, 17 years old, was murdered on Bloody Sunday.
John Kelly works at the Museum of Free Derry in the city's Bogside neighborhood. Kelly's brother and 13 others died when British soldiers opened fire on Catholics marching for civil rights.
I remember everything about the day. I remember it because it's ingrained in my memory and what happened. I remember it was a day like today, blue sky. The march itself, the people were very jubilant. I remember being in Roswell Street just outside the building when the paratroopers moved in, taking cover, knowing where the shooting was coming from, but not knowing who was being hit. I didn't see anybody being killed or injured. And the fact is, where I lay taking cover, my young brother was being shot dead about 40 yards from me. So Bloody Sunday has been a major part of my life ever since.
Some people have tried to make the argument that a return to a hard border would threaten the peace that people have worked so hard for. Do you think that's a legitimate fear, or is that fear-mongering?
To a degree, it's legitimate. But honestly, I see it as fear-mongering, truthfully. Because I don't believe, and I hopefully don't believe it'll ever happen, that we'll go back to the bad old days. Nobody wants to see the hard border again. I remember during the conflict here, which lasted for 30 years plus, and if you wanted to cross over the border, you had to go through the army checkpoints, police checkpoints and so on, being harassed, abused, arrested and so on. We don't want that anymore. What we have is an open island, if you want to call it. It's an invisible border.
You don't even know when you cross it. I did it today. I couldn't even tell.
Exactly. The only time when you realise you're over the border is when you're moving into the south. You go from miles into kilometres, or you go from sterling into euro. That is the only time. It's totally invisible. And that's the way this should be. But in relation to going back to the conflict, I see that maybe could happen, but I don't believe it will.
In 1998, the Good Friday Agreement officially ended the conflict and dismantled border checkpoints. But 20 years later, here in the Bogside, tensions still simmer. All through the neighborhood, people have spray-painted buildings and lampposts in support of the Irish Republican Army, the paramilitary group active during the Troubles. And this summer, riots broke out in the Bogside for six straight nights. Police say members of the new IRA threw firebombs at officers. I asked John Kelly if peace really is that tenuous.
Okay, there are certain groups out there who see themselves as possibly want to continue on with the war against the Brits for United Ireland. But peace is here, and peace is going to remain. And certainly Brexit hopefully will not affect that peace.
In a neighborhood like this, it feels almost naive to ask you if you trust the British government to figure this out. They've promised no return to a hard border. Do you think they'll follow through?
Don't trust the Brits. That's the way I see things.
Mommy! Daddy! Over here!
Like it is most days, Derry was tranquil on Sunday morning. 2+ years after the Brexit vote, the sun was still shining, albeit weakly, as families pushed strollers across the city's symbolic Peace Bridge. It spans the River Foyle and connects the Catholic side of town with the Protestant.
I'm very optimistic. I don't see problems that can't be overcome. A bit of common sense here and there.
Jeff Marshall is still bullish on Brexit. In a district where 78% of people chose to remain in Europe, he voted to leave.
So, always optimistic.
That's good.
I've just been to 100-year anniversary of the war. We've been through a lot worse problems and got through them. When you see the devastation and then the local stuff here 30 years ago, there's no comparison with what they're talking about now. This is kid stuff. Just get on with it.
He believes the Prime Minister will do just that and end the unhappy marriage between Europe and the United Kingdom for good. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd, reporting from Northern Ireland.
In covering the California fires, we've taken the wide view, the number of deaths, the homes lost. But we want to narrow the lens down right now to show how little losses can have big consequences as well. Gabe Price is a 17-year-old senior at Paradise High School, a promising runner. He thought he might be watching his college running career go up in the smoke of the campfire. Gabe, tell us first, what did the fire do to your family in Paradise?
Well, I mean, if you look at it from the outside, the fire took just about everything we had. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it didn't take our family, but all of our, like our house, our shop, just all of our belongings are, you know, it's all gone.
So that is big picture, and that is profoundly important, all those losses. But at the same time, when we're hearing at times like this, it's a little normalcy that sometimes can, you know, bring you to your knees when you don't have that. And we understand that you were about to run to qualify for the state cross-country championship when the fire happened. And you weren't going to be able to qualify?
Yeah, the same day that the fire broke out, you know, and took the whole community in a day, that was supposed to just be a regular day. And our team was actually set to qualify as a team. And, you know, when you start training year-round for something like just one singular race, just especially now being a junior and a senior, trying to look out for D2s and D1s and running in the future and scholarships and all that fun jazz. It really becomes just, it's important. Yeah.
Yeah. I met young people after Hurricane Andrew in Florida. Big strapping young men were in tears because they couldn't have their football game. And they knew, just like you do, that that's not really the most important thing, but it's just, mm-hmm. it's something you can hold on to. Well, the runners in the next town over, Chico High School, offered to rerun the qualifier so you could be included?
Mm-hmm.
What'd you think when you heard that?
Well, I kind of had already come to terms with not running. And that it was when I heard that, it was my coach that first told me. He said, "Hey, we're going to get you to state, and here's a second opportunity." I was ecstatic. And so.
Well, so you reran, you qualified, but it hasn't stopped there. You all need to train now for the championships, and it's too smoky there in Butte County. So you are now out on the coast, staying in the town of Fieldbrook, running at Humboldt State. This is a five-hour drive from Paradise. Mm-hmm. Eight of you, I understand, from Chico and Paradise, are staying at the home of the grandparents of another runner. You were competitors. Now you're, like, training together. Does running become a place to just maybe feel like you can breathe again?
Yeah, I'd say that's actually a really good way of putting it. It was just a place to clear my mind. It's really been a blessing.
I'm imagining you miss your family, but I bet this gives them some peace of mind knowing that you are continuing on a path.
Yeah, I actually wasn't really going to go in the beginning just because I wanted to stay with the family. And it actually took them to say, no, you should really go. They wanted me to be able to experience this.
Yeah, I bet. Well, I'm thinking another advantage here is what sounds like the good cooking of the grandparents of Charlie Giannini, the senior at Chico High, whose grandparents' homes you're staying in. Is he there? Can I speak to him for a second?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, Charlie.
Hi.
Listen, your team said we'll run again so that he and others could qualify. I'm thinking the Paradise High School football team just seeded its entire season. No shot for them. Did you ever hesitate? I mean, let's face it, we're all human, and you could have said, hey, you know, let's get them out of the competition. I mean, you know, you didn't have to do that.
Yeah, I think for all of us it was a no-brainer. We've been racing against Gabe and with Gabe for all of our years, and to see him not go to state, that would just be another tragedy on top of what's going on. Yeah.
Well, let me talk to Gabe again. Gabe, so you'll be running in the 2018 state cross-country championships the Saturday after Thanksgiving in Fresno. Do you feel, Gabe, that you're running for other people too, running for Paradise, running to give somebody else something to cheer for?
Yeah, I know that my team, that they really should have had a shot at qualifying. And so that kind of, at the same time for me, even though I'm a little bit upset about it, it also makes me want to go and do better at state just for them.
I can't imagine what the crowd's going to do when, you know, a runner from Paradise comes out. So, I mean, you know, so go for it. Gabe Price, senior cross-country runner from Paradise High School. Gabe, we wish you all the best.
Yeah, thank you.
And our thanks as well to Charlie Giannini and the entire cross-country team of Chico High, which joined them in the studio there in Arcata, California, with their adopted Paradise High runner, Gabe. We'll have a picture at herenow.org. We need a smile. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson at the BBC in London. This is Here and Now.